Well, the subtext for this really could be called, "Can these bones live?" And in many respects, it seems to me that our churches are a valley of dry bones. And yet they have the potential to redeem the world. I am a child of the church. And despite all its warts, flaws, sins, and horror, I love it. And as such, I want it to be as redemptive and as full of grace as it possibly can be. So that's kind of the thrust behind everything I've been doing this week so far. On Monday, I talked about Ronald Heifetz's understandings of adaptive challenges, and just a quick recap. Heifetz, it's not rocket science. He draws a very interesting contrast between what he calls technical challenges, things that we know how to fix, broken arms, flat tires, leaky roofs, and adaptive challenges, which are things that we don't know how to fix. We might think we know how to fix, but sometimes we not only don't know the answer, we aren't even sure what the right question is to ask. Those kinds of things where we find ourselves in a real cloud. I was talking to Rebecca a couple of days ago, who went up Martin's Ridge on Sunday before the rain came in and the fog came in, and they really took them 12 hours to get up and back. There are things in the life of communities of faith which are beyond our ability to comprehend. And how do we address some of those? So we talked some about those yesterday, or 2 days ago. Yesterday, what did we talk about yesterday? I can't even remember. That's pretty terrible.
Scarcity.
Thank you. How do you deal with scarcity, which is as much an occasion for sin as abundance? And the pressures and stresses of trying to live in situations where there simply isn't enough. That is one kind of adaptive challenge, and this one is another kind of adaptive challenge. How do we know if we're doing well? How do we know how well our church is doing it, doing good? And how do we do that without counting? Can churches be faithful in America? And how would we know? All right, what's it like out there? What's the world for the church in North America at this point in time? Mike was talking about Kennedy and his speech to the Southern Baptists earlier today, and how he made such a clear, compelling case that religion is a private thing. He could be a president who was a Catholic, but not necessarily a Catholic president. In this sort of separation of church and state environment in which we live, religion is voluntary. That means you don't have to belong to a state church. It also carries the meaning that if there's something you don't like, you can walk at any time. And therefore, people do. So voluntary religion, which leads to a situation that some folks describe as competition among churches. And they compare religious life in the United States in particular with the market. And so that's out there. We may not buy it, but it's there. Rise of the mega. Over the last 30 years, Willow Creek Community Church, Saddleback, what are the others? You know, there's a host of mega churches. In the United States, at least, we have lots of small congregations, but increasing numbers of people who are part of larger congregations. The proportion of American Protestants who are part of large congregations has increased drastically in the last 25 years. Megachurches, which are different critters, they command media attention. If you watch carefully a local metropolitan newspaper, they seem to have calendar files that they rotate stories through, so about every... Well, it's like the cover of Newsweek every year right before Easter. They always do a Jesus story.
local metropolitan papers usually do an annual story on one or two mega churches. So that's going on in our culture. And those things may also impact the way we understand what faithful congregational life is like. Rise of the conservatives. Certainly, our culture where I live in the Mid-South is dominated by religious conservatives. We used to joke that it took us 7 years to find the first family or the first other family in our county that were Democratic. And it is amazing how much of an impact conservative Christianity has on political life. So in Tennessee, the legislature was entertaining a don't say gay bill this year. They were also, and that's clearly religious, coming from religious roots. They were also, and they passed a bill on creation science that mandated that alongside the teaching of evolution in scientific classrooms, creation science must be taught. So conservative religion, yeah, it's not just in the South. I hear there's things going on in Minnesota. Yeah, okay. So the rise of conservative religion. I don't know what your stripe is right now. I'm not conservative, but that doesn't mean you can't be. I am sort of like the Rodney King line, why can't we all get along, and would like to promote dialogue when it's possible.
Where is that museum, that creation museum?
Oh, thankfully.
Is that in Tennessee?
No, thank goodness. That's in Kentucky.
Kentucky.
Close to Cincinnati in Ohio. Yeah, it's up there along the river. Thanks for mentioning it. They're about to open a big theme park right next to Bible Land. Either they have or it's about to open. Yeah, so you can hit both venues when you take a vacation next time. Other things that are going on, playing down of church. I think church is generally devalued in our culture. It no longer holds the place in community life that it once did. In the same way that pastors have experienced a drastic drop in status, church is no longer that visible and present. Now, again, in the Mid-South, you would be hard-pressed to know that. It seems like there's a very large church on almost every corner. But nationally, church is much less significant. Denominational links are being played down. I don't know if you read anything about the recent Southern Baptist Convention. They actually have tried to adopt an alternative name that people can use because Southern Baptist still connotes Civil War era, pro-slavery, basically, pro-Southern, pro-states' rights, and has carried that connotation forward in their eyes. So they're trying, and lots of Southern Baptist churches no longer call themselves Southern Baptist. They might call themselves the People's Church. I always thought that was a nice irony. But, yeah.
But there's a different segment of Baptists, the American Baptists.
Correct. Northern Baptists.
Northern Baptists, mm-hmm. And they're more liberal.
Yes.
Is that growing?
No.
No.
Well, some are, but they tend to be more like this. New things that seem a little odd. Let me see. We return to a couple of articles that I've saved. One of them is it's old, 2002, but it's so fun that I saved it. It was a study of the 1990s and the rise of the conservatives and the megachurches and so forth. This is a quote from someone who is assessing the statistical information that he had gathered. I was astounded to see that by and large growing churches are those that we ordinarily call conservative. And when I looked at those that were declining, most were moderate or liberal churches. And the more liberal the denomination, by most people's definition, the more they were losing. The churches that lost the highest percentages of members in the 90s were the Presbyterian Church USA, almost 12%, and the United Church of Christ, about 15%. So at the same time that's going on, we get all sorts of interesting, innovative new things like this. A hipster synagogue in Soho drawing large crowds with its Torah cocktail parties in fancy loft apartments and user-friendly prayer services designed especially for the uninitiated. A group of New York area congregations
refashion their synagogues into religious multiplexes on the Sabbath, featuring programs like Shabbat yoga and comedy alongside of traditional worship. So we're getting a lot of, well, we could call it innovative, or you could call it what you want. There was a feeling that the old structures weren't working, said the rabbi. The world is a different world. There's a greater marketplace of spiritual options for people. If synagogues are not compelling places, who's going to bother to join and be involved? Well, frankly, that is a question with a little bit of merit. We can't just ignore it. Okay, and then we have the whole spiritual, not religious thing. I don't know how we get past that one. I find it to be frustrating, but it's so widespread, it's almost impossible even to argue it. Well, tell me about your churches, actually. I'm curious to hear a little about your churches. How many people go to a church that averages over 500 on Sunday morning? Okay. How many people go to a church that you would say was simple and plain? Anybody? Okay. How about flashy ones? Our denominational president a few years ago once said that ordinations among the disciples of Christ were becoming more like coronations. And he was pointing to the increase in flesh, you know, really spectacular vestments and things like that. Yeah, yeah. Oh, city, suburb, country. How many of you are in country churches here? This is interesting. I'm finding out a little bit about the population. How about city churches? Urban, okay. Suburban? About half and half.
Half away from the city border. So what is that?
Interurban? Yeah. Anybody here go to a church that you would characterize as poor? Uh-huh. And how, can you tell me why?
Billings, Montana, it's the smallest church in the town and in kind of the hoodie section.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. Anybody in what you would characterize as a wealthy congregation? How come?
Well, we just had a capital campaign and raised $8
million
with
$12.
$12?
Oh my gosh.
Want to lend me one?
Well, but there are things that come with that, right?
Yeah, there is. Okay. So the rest of you are middle class. This is America, isn't it? We all say we're middle class. Huh. Okay. How many of you would characterize your worship as formal?
Define formal.
Well, traditional is different.
Yeah, ours is a Lutheran church, liturgical that way. But for a Lutheran church, I would say I'm not terribly formal.
Okay. Do lay people in the pews make announcements during the service?
Okay.
Uh-huh. Okay. How many of you then would characterize as informal? Many of you? Okay. These are just sort of arbitrary, you know, terms I'm throwing out just to think about what's going on. Classical, traditional, contemporary. How many of you are in contemporary style congregations?
We're talking about the building.
No, let's talk about the worship service. Thank you for that clarification.
Well, it depends when you go. What Sunday of the month it is.
Okay. So which service do you go to?
I like the contemporary.
Okay. And how do you know it's a contemporary service?
They don't play the darn organ.
They don't play the the darn organ. Jazz, okay. That's interesting. Yeah.
Professional jazz.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Not paid, but.
Good.
Gifted musicians in our church.
And it used to be said that a contemporary worship service is one with drums.
But what you're describing now is moving past that into a little more diversity, and you're all pointing out that it's one without the organ. It's easier now to describe that as without organ, perhaps, in a lot of respects. How many of you go to a, did I ask this, traditional service? No? Do you go to a traditional service with organ? Let's just say organ.
Yeah.
How many of you do that? Okay.
What's the difference between classical or traditional?
Well, you can be traditional with an organ, with a choir and robes and everything like that, but not really focus on classical music as the bedrock. Lots of traditional churches, at least in my part of the country, would not be trotting out the Bach fugues, but they would certainly be traditional. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so here's really, this is just to sort of seed the cloud. Pardon me?
It
does.
Churches that are some of all of that.
Yeah.
And how is that working?
Great.
Okay, and how does it function? Do you have multiple services?
No, we have one congregation, so if during the school year when there's two services, they're identical.
Okay.
But we rotate through four or five different settings of the liturgy. Some are led with piano, some are led with a small group, an ensemble, what we call a band, but some of the people wouldn't.
Yes.
Not amplified. Some are led by the organ. Once in a while, there is a band that's amplified. Sure.
Great. That's kind of a classic definition of what people call blended worship.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually really hard to pull off and much more rare than you would think. So, interesting to hear. All right, so when you describe, just a few people here, when you describe your church to friends, you know, what do you say? Pick one word that you would, or one or two or three words.
Welcome. Inclusive.
Inclusive, okay.
Welcoming.
Welcoming.
Radical hospitality.
Okay.
Social justice.
Okay.
I call ours a mission church.
All right, and that's an interestingly different phrase. You know.
It's been in the neighborhood 100 years.
Well,
we have a shelter for homeless.
Okay. All right, these are interesting. I would love to have some of my Disciples of Christ ministry students here to listen to your comments, because that's probably what they all thought they would say about their churches as well, which makes you wonder, what's the difference? You know, and intriguing. We're not picking up necessarily on theological or traditional differences so much anymore.
Or ethnic.
Yeah. Well, what we're doing here is thinking about different ways of understanding church. Here's a second option beyond the usual kind of numerical things that people deal with. Richard Lisher has a delightful memoir of his first 3 years in ministry called Open Secrets. And he grew up, I think, Lutheran in St. Louis, went entirely through a Lutheran school system, went to one of the many Concordia seminaries, and got a PhD, and returned to his St. Louis synod, and was assigned to a small rural church in western Illinois, about 30 miles from St. Louis. And this is what he says as he drives up for the first time to park in front of the church to which he has been assigned. He looks at the little humble church and he prays, "Oh Lord, is this what you have prepared for me?" How do we know? How do we know? Two different kinds of ways of thinking about church. A few weeks ago, I was sitting in an ordination interview with a candidate from a church in Memphis. This was a mature African-American man who had retired as a postal worker. He had grown up in North Memphis, Riverview Christian Church, he said. He said that this church had an old building in a bad neighborhood. The building had been abandoned. The communion table had been stolen. All the windows were broken. The doors were missing. The air conditioner had been removed and taken away. And he said he heard the voice of God telling him to go and build it. He said, this is a great location. there's lots of drugs and alcohol in the neighborhood. What a great place to put a church.
Yeah.
These are my scribbled notes. I thought, wow, you know, he did not know about St. Francis of Assisi and Francis's Rebuild My Church. Okay, so what is faithful? That's really the question I want to ask. Quantity or quantity is one way to put this. What makes for good in church? Numbers of worshipers, great preachers, large staffs, I forgot to say, credentials, big budgets, lots of programs, impressive buildings, massive outreach, amazing faith. What makes for good when a church is good? I want to make just this statement today, and then I'm going to try and spin it out a little bit, and then we can talk. I think we can ask the question of what makes something good, and I think that question, which is a question of assessment, can be meaningful if it isn't even obviously measurable. Does that make sense? Something can be meaningful without necessarily being measurable. Now, we live in a culture that values numbers. We count everything. So it's a constant temptation to count. Can we measure and assess without counting? And, you know, if you're an ethicist, what I'm going to say is really obvious. We can think about things in terms of some categories from ethics that are really quite useful. And it shouldn't be any surprise that we turn to the discipline of ethics to think about the good. What is the worth? What is the value of something? That is exactly what the discipline of ethics tries to think about. How do we know the good? How do we do the good? And so ethics brings us, I think, some helpful ways. Actually, it's a practical discipline. You can take it and say, oh, well, let's ask these questions about congregational life, and maybe they will provide us with a different window on the world of assessing our faithfulness in community. So here's this first category, this first kind of way of thinking about ethics. And it's pretty obvious. Rules. We follow rules. The best action is one that is guided by either rules or general principles. So what's the best example of an ethical command or mandate or principle that we can think of from the Old Testament? The Ten
Commandments.
Okay. See how that works? I mean, we have general principles that would say it is always better to preserve life. It is always better to remain faithful in relationship. It is never good to take the Lord's name in vain. It is never good to kill. It is always critical to honor our parents. Those are larger general principles and rules for living. Some of them are broad and general. Some of them are quite specific. There are over, 400 and some different specific commands for the Torah, in the Torah. Very specific things. Some of them very detailed and specific. Well, okay, so if we take that way of thinking about life in community, life in congregations, we all have mission statements, don't we? That's been the biggest trend to sweep organizational life in the last 30 years. Everybody has a mission statement, even if it doesn't mean anything. And usually they don't. My bias is to say we often do a lot of work creating statements, and then we think the work is done. And the statements we create are usually so broad as to be, you know, almost impossible to judge anything by. But a mission statement in an organization is in some ways an expression of a general principle. I prefer something that I'm trying to call here a statement of purpose or calling. Mission statement, obviously, it emerged from the church, was co-opted by the world of organizations, and has lost most of its meaning. So I tend to want to talk about what is our calling rather than what is our mission. it has stronger grounding in the lives of community of faith. So a statement of calling might go on for quite a ways and might give us much more detail in terms of interpreting a more general statement for its use within a particular community, a particular people, in a particular place, and a particular time, trying to be faithful. We also have rules and policies, all sorts of bylaws and constitutions and things like that that we follow. And these are examples of rules in congregations. Questions to ask yourself in terms of if you want to make use of that first piece, a rule-based assessment. What is God calling us to be and do here and now? All of those pieces are important to me, at least. God, call us, be and do here in this place now. A second subsidiary way to think about your church is to say, are we doing things in the right way? And are we doing the right things? And that means, you know, if you've got bylaws and policies, follow them. Don't make idols of them, but they're there for a reason, so use them. All right. Any questions about that? That's a pretty straightforward thing. Let's go with the second one. Consequences or outcomes or those kinds of things. The best action can be ascertained because it does the greatest good for the greatest number of people. Measurements fit here. And this is, in fact, if we're going to assess congregations in our culture, this is primarily and even solely the one that gets used. How many? Fill in the blank. You ask of your church, you know, how many new members have you had in the last 6 months? How many baptisms? What's your budget? How much income do you get? How much do you spend on outreach? How many people attend the church? How many members do you have? How much square footage do you have? And on and on and on. How many parking lots or parking spaces in the parking lot? How many cribs in the nursery? How many bathrooms with changing tables? These are all ridiculous, small, trivial things that can facilitate larger things. But the ease of counting in our culture makes them almost the golden calf. You know what I'm talking about. You're here because this is not satisfactory to you. Questions to ask yourself that get away from those kind of external, superficial measures. Are we making a difference? Well, obviously, you've got to say in what and how would you know. Does our bias affect our interpretation? I'm skipping to the last line here. When you count, it is almost inevitable in our culture that we equate larger or more with better. And as the song says, it ain't necessarily so. The things that you're liable to read in the Bible. Okay.
What's the difference between outcome and output?
Thanks. I'm glad you got back to that one. It's a good question, and it's one that's being used in nonprofits quite a bit these days. When we try to measure consequences, we often find ourselves measuring an output. I don't really like this way of thinking too much because it seems industrial to me. It's like you take raw materials, put them into a production process, and then you output something. But people, for example, in social service agencies, you said you had a homeless shelter in your church. And how do you measure the value of the work you do? Don't you count the number of bed nights you provide in a season?
It's counted, but that's mostly required if we're applying for grants.
Federal grants?
It's probably not how we really evaluate the program. It's a necessary thing, but it's not simple focus.
Good. That's good. But that's the kind of question that's asked. How many meals are you serving per month, for example? How many bed nights are you providing? That is an output, but an outcome is, are people becoming healthier? Is the community housing its homeless? Is the community becoming more welcoming and sheltering? Those, see where I'm going with that? Seminaries like to measure how many Masters of Divinity students they graduate.
Well, in my tradition, it is an output. In my tradition, they always report all denominations combined. They don't even report how many from our tradition or other traditions. They don't say how many went on to get ordained. They don't say, and of those who got ordained, this many went into pastoral ministry, this many went into chaplaincy, this many went into higher education. And how are they doing 5, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years down the road? Outcomes are horribly hard to get your handle or to get your hands around. But that's why we tend to measure outputs. And the kind of thing that nonprofits are beginning to ask themselves is, do you count what you can measure, or do you measure what counts? You've heard that contrast? Okay. These are good things to do, but we have to be aware of our biases. And our biases tend to be that more is better, and that what we can count is what's important. And that's limited. Another form of thinking about ethics is called character or virtue ethics. And basically it talks about how people grow in goodness over time and virtues within an individual that indicate a strong or faithful character are the things that count. How can we think about churches in those terms? Can we? Well, I want to say good churches, there's the worth word, good, are made up of good people doing good things well. See all the value words I've got in that sentence? Those are all character virtue words, every one of them. How do we think about this? Well, a real trend in thinking about ministry in the last 10 years has been to examine what is excellence in ministry. That's a great question. I want to say to you that excellence is so context dependent that it's just a great exercise for all of you to think about in your own place with your own people. What is excellence here? So these questions were tough to come up with, and I hope they're suggestive and that you will think up your own better versions. But are we doing this work we do, this ministry, faithfully? There's a value word that requires some defining or describing. Caringly and well. We can serve meals to the homeless, but if we do it in a grinchy, inhospitable manner, you know, it may be a gourmet feast served with bitterness is much less of a meal than a simple meal served with welcome and care. Do the spiritual gifts of the people in the ministry match their calling? Jim Collins, some of you might have heard of him, he wrote Good to Great, kind of a real hot book in the leadership circles. He talks about getting the right people on the bus. And I translated that into church language by talking about spiritual gifts and calling. Lots of churches will try to help people self-examine and find where their gifts are located and help them find ways to use those. Are we building toward faithfulness? That this is a context specific question that you would have to ask. One of Paul's primary words in his writings as he thinks about what happens in congregations is edification, to edify, to build up the body of Christ. Is the work we do building up the body of Christ? And that last question echoes this. Does what we are assessing strengthen our sense of identity and calling? That assumes that we have an identity and calling, and that is a faithful one that should be edified. Not always a safe assumption. Those are really three of the main kinds of schools of ethical reflection. Here's another one. You all of a certain age heard situation ethics somewhere back in the 60s and 70s. Basically, what that means is ethics has to take into account the appropriateness of action within a specific context. You might have read Poisonwood Bible. It tells the story of a headstrong father who drags his family to Central Africa to do mission work. And basically, his intent is not only to save their souls, but it's to convert them to Anglo-American, Protestant, Democratic Christianity. and he intends to, technologically and scientifically as well, and he intends a demonstration vegetable garden, and he brings along a bunch of seeds from Georgia, where the family comes from, and he plants them all, and they all start to grow up and thrive and flourish, and then they die. No fruits happen on those plants because the pollinators where he is are different from the pollinators at his home in Georgia, and nothing bears fruit, and it finally gets washed away. The whole book is summed up in that story, frankly. Well, first half of the book, it's a pretty powerful example of someone who is so badly fit to the situation that it's a reversal of what Joseph says to his family when they show up in Egypt. You know, it's not you intended it for evil, but God turned it to good. It's you intended it for good, but somehow you have turned it to evil.
And he remained oblivious.
Yes.
You know, the wife and the daughters caught on to the ways of where they were.
Mm-hmm.
And the people there responded to them.
He was Baptist. And you know how Baptists baptize, right?
Yep.
Okay. That's right. Well, disciples do the same thing. Don't hold it against me. It's a wonderful form of baptism, and it often is practiced in rivers. And the father begins to try to convert the people in the local village, and he wants to take them out to be baptized in the river, and he's oblivious to the fact that a small girl from the village has been eaten by a crocodile within the last month. They won't go near the river. They think when he wants to take him to be baptized. Yeah. Hyphus, I mentioned him earlier. One of the things he talks about in terms of change is that to facilitate change means to take the context seriously and to be aware of whether something is ripe or not. He would, I think, argue that pushing an unripe issue is often counterproductive. And so this is just another example of how contextual fit is just key. Questions to ask. What is most appropriate to our character and calling? And there's, again, character, calling, identity. These words are coming up, and assuming you have those, I love the word fit and the word appropriate. Those are questions that ask us, is this the right thing for this place and this time? And then the last form of thinking about ethics is often called liberation ethics, and it would say something we do is only good if it leads to greater human flourishing and redemption. In some ways, I think of this as a form of rule-based ethic. It is a rule, but it's a very specific one. It says we need to be about human flourishing and redemption. The O for the P. Have any of you read Tracy Kidder's book, Mountains Beyond Mountains?
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about, don't you? Yeah. All the workers for Partners in Health, the group that Paul Farmer starts in Haiti, use this as shorthand. A preferential option for the poor, which comes out of Roman Catholic liberation theology, Central America, South America, 70s, 80s, and has a lot of power. It basically says God's option. God prefers the poor, and everything we do must be measured by that and that alone.
Isn't that what Alan said yesterday, too?
Alan, was it?
Oh, sorry.
Are we promoting human flourishing? Are we transforming not just individual lives, but systems? Are we furthering the well-being of the entire creation? These are very practical questions that you can ask of what your community of faith does and is. Ethics is great. Okay, so there we have those five again. Rules, consequences, or outcomes, character, or virtue, context, and liberation.
should have added, eat meals together, be hospitable and loving to one another. That's really all I have to say. So if you want to talk?
What was the second one? Could you just go back to those three?
Consequences.
Really want to quibble, but in this slide previous to this one, he posed the question of whether we're working only for individual lives but also systemic change. And it seems to me that an awful lot of what we do doesn't focus on systemic change at all. To the extent that we encounter something that we believe to be wrong, we apply palliatives. We provide some food for those who are hungry. We provide, you know, some housing vouchers or bus vouchers or something like that. But going beyond that, certainly in my denomination, I'm Episcopalian, I'm sure there are people who don't believe it's their business to be working at systemic change. They really feel that they're called, and I'm laughing because I was about to say, to preserve the faith at a time when it's going away. You know, I just wonder if anybody else elsewhere in the communion wrestles with that.
That was a question to everybody.
Go ahead. In the work that I do with the congregation where I serve, I have spent a lot of time talking with them about the 2 feet of our service to others, and one is that direct service. That it seems to be easier to feed the hungry person, to shelter the homeless person. And then the systemic change, which is to try to address the questions or the problems that, you know, we have so many homeless, hungry, lonely people. There's a story that I'm sure a lot of you have heard, but I find it a really good teaching tool about the people that came upon a village, and there was all these people in the river. I sometimes tell them about the river creek. And there were all these people being swept downstream, and there were some, not all were dead, but they were. And the villagers rushed in to take out as many people and rescue as many people as they could. And they did this for days and days. And finally, somebody went to the river with them. But they started going upstream. And where are you going? Where are you going? Well, I'm going to go see who's throwing all these people. A lot of the conversation that light bulbs go off and go, oh, I get it. It's harder to go up river. It takes more time.
But it takes a different skill set.
It does
as well.
And a different calling.
Right.
And a different calling.
And you can't assume that every pastor or every rector is going to have both sets of skills. And so, you know, do we wind up?
Or the other leaders of the church.
Yeah. Hopefully, there's someone in the congregation that is called to that work. And then hopefully, the people that are called to direct service don't see it as a competition or an impediment or a instead of, but a both and. And hopefully, the leadership of it, there's a lot of hopefullys in there, right?
Yeah.
But it's true. I mean, the leadership needs to see this as well, this is what we're being called into now. Being this community now, this time, and I think more leaders are learning that what was our calling 10 years ago or 50 years ago might not be our calling now, and more leaders are open to sharing leadership as well and bringing up leaders from within the congregation.
Is it at our church? We did at one time just have a shelter where people would come and sleep, and we would provide the food for them.
Mm-hmm.
You guys can help me out.
The emergency shelter in the winter, just keeping people warm.
And then it wasn't really working too well. It was the bodies in the river. And so now it's much smaller, and we're partnering with people that have expertise in helping counseling and providing job skills,
right,
and all those kind of things. And so we reached out. Maybe we didn't have the expertise, but there are people that do. And so, you know, you partner with other people. And that's only to the good. And now it's, working a lot better. I don't know.
Well, the numbers are smaller, actually. We had 40, 50 people in our gym between November and March before. And that's a lot of people. Big numbers. Now we have maybe 8 to 15 men in the shelter. They learn how to, you know, life skills again. They've been through alcoholism, drugs, whatever. They learn to be in community with each other, you know, to shop for food, to cook, to look after each other, but the numbers are a lot smaller.
In Minneapolis, well, Edina Community has partnered, there's a Plymouth Foundation that has to do with Plymouth Congregational Church and Westminster Presbyterian Church. And they have a nonprofit organization that gets grants for affordable housing. And they took over a three-floor cement block. Years ago, it had been a motel across from one of these big power churches. Now that's housing for people with mental health and substance abuse issues. And recently, Edina Community is partnering with a nonprofit, and the market is homeless youth. Every night in Minnesota, or in Minneapolis, the Bethel County area, 2,500 kids don't have a bed to sleep in. And the thing that we're using, the physical plant that we're using as a model and consulting with their staff on how to do this, is just in its second year of being a reality. And these people can range from 16 to 23. And they get in there by lottery, which just catches your heart. And they have a brand new, large, one-room apartment with their own bathroom, and for the first time, many of them have a key to a door that they can lock and be private or be safe. And they have there's a staff 24/7, and they work with them on job issues, perhaps getting back to school. So I'm hopeful, but it's...
Just to go on one more second on this line, this is a terribly complex problem. We're talking about need, we're talking about systemic change, we're talking about churches which have not only, let's talk about the, I mean, let's just set aside the kind of ornery sinful stuff that goes on that subverts the calling and mission and faithfulness of congregations. That's all too common, that's all over the place. Churches are toxic. But even if they're healthy, the amount of competing callings going on is just almost impossibly complex to navigate. So you do have legitimately people who say, I'm here to worship. I'm here to uphold the tradition. That's a good thing. Neither of those are bad things. Then you have people who say, I'm here and I want to minister to someone face to face. I want to meet someone's needs. That's a good thing. Then you have folks who say, you know, we need to go beyond that. We have to pick a target and try to address it in a more comprehensive, systemic fashion. That's a good thing. All pulling in different directions. It's really complex. And how do we foster... we talk about being inclusive and welcoming. That was a big theme early in this together. How can we be inclusive and welcoming of one another and our various callings? How can we also discern those callings in gracious, gentle ways and then require, we need to be harsh toward ourselves in terms of how we respond to our calls. But, you know, if we can foster communities of kind of gracious hospitality toward one another and toward our sense of being diverse, we are diverse. It's really complicated to do that.
The economy changing, every nonprofit is scrambling for grant money. I mean, the pots are drying up, so to speak. So we've learned that you have to combine. You know, and what difference does it make? you know, whether it's Congregational, Presbyterian, or Lutheran, the point is a kid has a bed and a place to sleep.
So collaboration is another way we go about this. Yeah, that's a recently elevated strategy.
I'm not sure how this connects. When I went to seminary, reflecting on that time, I was trained to run a congregation, quote unquote. I joined because I loved Jesus, and they trained me to run a congregation. And I wonder if that's not part of the issue, that instead of making loving and following Jesus my primary responsibility, I run a congregation, which is not very attractive. Following Jesus and loving Jesus is very attractive, and I think attractive to witness as well. And if, maybe looking at your trends earlier, which I think my country shares, your megachurch, your spiritual, not religious, all that kind of stuff, the one that seems to, or a example that seems to not go down that road is Taizé in France. Which one way of speaking of Taizé, I guess, is the largest mega youth church in the world. That every single day, not just on a Sunday, but every single day in summer will have over 6,000 young people. And I want to know why they go there. Could it be that the brothers and linked sisters there said, I want to follow Jesus because I love Jesus, and they create a space for you to love and follow Jesus. When you join the community, you don't suddenly learn how to run Taizé. And so the people who go there simply to witness followers of Jesus, and they seem to be going there in their thousands, because when Jesus is lifted up, people are drawn. I don't know how that kind of connects, but it's some of the thoughts that I've been.
I'm glad you said it in that way, because I think one of my biases or underlying things is we follow and love Jesus in human community, not as individuals. We do it as individuals, but not as individuals alone. And when we come together in community, usually we develop patterns and habits and ways of being together that I will call institutional, and acknowledge that institutions often do terrible things, because just like Sabbath becoming the overriding concern, we lose sight of that for which Sabbath was given. We lose sight so easily in our human institutions of the treasure that they are carrying. But it seems to me that we inevitably develop them. And so what I am concerned to do, realizing that this is not possible outside of the grace of God and the eschaton, is to make those institutions a little more reductive than they are. And I used to be more idealistic about that. I now think if I can get it from 49% to 51%, that's something. Because we live in institutions. They're all around us. Those are the systems that oppress us and bind us. And if there are some things we can do, particularly in the redemptive community, to make those institutions serve the call of God. That's what I'm talking about. And you're right, we live in this, particularly in this industrialized counting culture in which
all that crap is thrown in our faces. But I want to hold out for a different way of being. How do we be together in a place, in a time, with the people more faithfully? And I think we can. I think we can do better than we are. But I am an unabashed institutionalist, even though I was a rebel when I was younger. because I've seen how, at least in my own ministry, a community and an institution can transform and can have redemptive impact, even if it doesn't save the world. I don't want to pretend we can do that. I read enough Luther in divinity school to know better. But I think we can do something. And so that's where I go with that. And Taizé is an interesting institution to think about because it's so diverse. It's kind of like those large mushrooms in the Arctic that seem to spread and have duration. They're very, very, very large underground connected things. It's really interesting in that respect. There's a house church movement in this country that is quite intriguing and vital. That seeks to avoid some of the institutional trappings that we get caught with, the kind of buildings, staff, those sorts of things. There are always movements of the spirit that are seeking to renew a church that inevitably seems to fall into sin. How do we negotiate that dynamic is a really tough and worthwhile question. And I hope these are some helpful tips. We got 1 minute and then one question. Go ahead.
To go back and to kind of come around to Alan Story's point, it seems like a lot of kind of the numbers game questions is about, it comes from kind of an empire state of mind, right? Empires have to deal with numbers, so they have to figure out how to keep the hungry fed just enough and the poor, you know, earning just enough. So Christians shouldn't be worried about charity because charity is just enough and it's faceless, it's us and them. But Christians should be concerned with compassion, which always deals in relationships. So I'm very blessed to have a good example in our church. Like the smaller numbers allows for better relations. And we can have locks on our bathroom doors in the recovery, in the hygiene center, because about 80% of those people are using drugs, and it's just not, it doesn't make sense. And so you have some of the women complaining that they don't feel safe in the bathrooms because there's no locks. But that's the population there are. And so it has to be, for churches, it has to be contextual. It has to be a community that's in relationship with the community around them. And like Taizé, it has to be a faithful community. It has to have a rich interior life, but it can't just stop at that. Which I haven't been to Taizé, but it seems like that's why it's so appealing, is because it's a deeply set apart interior path and place in a world that's just so chaotic and so distractible.
And it looks to me like Holden Village echoes some of those same things.
Yeah.
Well, it is 5 o'clock, and I know we need to call time. I'm sorry, you had a question that I didn't capture.
Yeah, make a comment.
Please do.
There is a book that addresses a lot of this called The Emerging Church, and there are some other books too, but the part of The Emerging Church that I find particularly helpful is the contemplative movement, which has its roots in, actually a lot of Catholic monks. And we happen to belong to a church that's Lutheran and Catholic. We're Lutheran. I've gained a lot from people like Thomas Wilson and Richard Rohr, who are contemplatives. And so that makes, has helped me to integrate Christianity into my everyday life, rather than going to church and having kind of save me in my life. And, so that's something I think is pretty powerful and can really make a church more meaningful for people to focus on.
that's a helpful way to end. Thank you for being here, and I hope this was helpful, and we'll look forward to further conversations.